You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jason and Jamie. Today we're looking at the question regarding how does God's sovereignty over all things relate to the question or the issue of suffering. And I think a great place to start off as we look at sovereignty from this perspective as it relates to suffering, and then as it relates to the next two episodes, we'll look at how it relates to prayer and how it affects our prayer lives, what it means for our prayer lives, and then also how it relates to our salvation. But a good place to start off when looking at the question of suffering in relation to God's work in the world is the book of Job. And I think this kind of sets the stage for us, Jamie, because Job is the classic example of a man who is a righteous man, suffers horribly throughout the book, and yet throughout it, he remains confident in God's sovereign power and control over his life and over the world in which he inhabits. And I think this is a great place to start, Jamie, because what we see here is, number one, the fact that Satan plays a role, at least in Job's suffering. That's how much we know from the book of Job. But I think it serves as a good example because here we have God who is confronted by Satan, and Satan essentially is asked by God, have you considered my servant Job? Now, to just start off, we have to ask the question, why did God even bring Job into the equation? Why did he bring this righteous man up? And we know God is omniscient. We know how Satan is going to respond. So we have to say, God knows that this question is, in a sense, goading Satan on, and it's going to provoke Satan to want to do something to Job to bring on suffering and to disprove God's assessment of Job when God says that Job is a righteous man who lives by trusting in me. And so what happens right after that is God gives Satan essentially free rein over destroying so much of Job's life, but he's not allowed to actually touch him, touch the man. I think the key line we see in that first chapter is that it says that then Job, in verse 20, Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. Now you think about that, he's worshiping God in the midst of this suffering that afflicts his life. He's lost his children, and he's had a good portion of his wealth taken away. So he's grieving, and he's facing this financial loss. And yet he says this, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And then just to be sure we are tracking and recognize what Job said, the narrator says in verse 22, "Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God." Part of us, or part of me, I'll say, wants to say, now hang on a second, he did blame God. He said, "The Lord has taken away." And that word there, that Hebrew word, could be translated accuse or indict God, essentially casting blame on God and saying, "You are the source, or you are the reason for my suffering." And yet he does ascribe to God this role of taking away. So how are we to make sense of this? Because clearly Job is suffering, he's in anguish, but yet he doesn't say one extreme would be to say God had nothing to do with this. God didn't want this to happen, and God is just as surprised as you, Job, about what happened. He doesn't say that. He says, you know, the Lord is the one who has given and taken away. But on the flip side of it, he doesn't cast blame on God and say this is all because of God acting evil, acting wickedly, I should say. Job is saying, you know, no matter what has directly caused this evil, God has everything in the palm of his hand. Nothing can happen outside of his sovereign will. That's why he's able to say, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. That's that That's ascribing God total control, total sovereignty. And yet the direct cause of this evil, as we read through the chapter, we see it. It's Satan. Satan is the one who, in some way, moved these raiders, these Sabaeans, to take away Job's livestock. And in some way, he seems to have been contributing to this great wind that struck down the four corners of the house that killed his children. Just based on the narrative, that's what we come away with, is Satan seems to be the direct cause of the evil, but yet God is the one who has been given ultimate credit for both giving and taking away. And I think this is where a lot of us want to read this and just work through it and think through, okay, but what does this mean for my life? If God is the ultimate one in control, and nothing happens outside of his sovereign will, what does that mean for me when I'm in the middle of suffering, when I'm facing trials that I don't want to be in my life? And I don't want this whatever it is, betrayal, grief, financial loss, job loss, whatever it is that could be the cause of suffering. How can we wrestle through that knowing God is in total control?
I think we also got to stop real quick here. We're using the term sovereignty of God, and I think it would be helpful to provide a context or a basis for that, right? I mean, there's obviously lots of definitions, but in terms of criteria, what is it that makes God sovereign, or why would we say God is sovereign over, I mean, not just, so we jumped right into the story, but I think it'd be helpful for our listeners that maybe aren't as familiar with the concept as a theological term. You want to maybe take a step back just real quick and give a definition for that?
And it's true because people on basically far different ends of the theological spectrum are going to use the term God's sovereignty. And generally, whether you have a high view or low view of God's sovereign control over things, you'll use that term, God's sovereignty. And the way I would define it just off the cuff is it is God's control, or his sovereign reign, his kingly reign over all things in his world. And that would mean that nothing happens outside of his whether you would call it his allowance or his outside of his control, outside of his permissive will, nothing happens, including the worst of evils. And so when we talk about God's sovereignty, we're saying that nothing sneaks up on God, nothing surprises God, nothing surpasses his...
The easy background... lens I like to think of it through is I call it the big four, right? God is creator, God is sustainer, God is orderer, and God's the highest authority. And you're, well, how do we know that? I mean, you look at, you go back to Genesis 1, in the beginning God, so God was, and then God creates, right? So God is the creator. The sustainer, we're told in like Hebrews 1 and Colossians 1, that all things are literally and physically held together by God. So God is the creator. God is the sustainer. God is the orderer. We see, again, looking at Genesis, and you see this in other places in the Bible as well, but clearly in Genesis, God lays out the order for all things, right? He creates man and woman in his image. He creates them with a purpose of ruling and reigning and subduing the earth, taking care of it, having dominion over it. And so there's an implicit order that is laid out by God. So he's creator, sustainer, orderer. And then my favorite one, which I know these are all really simple, but I think it's really important to recognize this when we're talking about sovereignty. What's the basis for saying that? Well, here it is. God is the four. And then that fourth one is to say that God is the highest authority. And how do we know that? And I love this. The book of Hebrews tells us in chapter 6, 13, I think, that God seeks out a higher authority to swear by. He goes searching, he goes looking in the cosmos for a higher authority than himself, and ends up finding none. And so what does he do? He swears by himself. So our confidence that God is the highest authority comes from the fact that God himself sought somebody higher than him and came back empty in that sense, because there is no one higher than God. God is the highest authority that could ever possibly be. So the fact that he swears by himself ensures or cements that reality for us. So God is creator, sustainer, orderer, and highest authority. That four, I think, while it's really simple concept, and I mean, you know, obviously we're not trying to talk down to anybody. I'm just a simple guy, and I love that concept, is really the basis. God's sovereignty is built on those things. I don't know. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that basic outline of why we should believe in God's sovereignty. And I think we see this in this connection between the true God, the creator God of everything, and the way he contrasts himself with the false gods who have been made by human hands. And we see this especially in Isaiah, especially in the chapters 40 through 48 or so. And there's one passage, Isaiah 45 has this section where God is declaring his total sovereignty. And he's saying, I'm not like the false gods who cannot tell you what is to come. And he says, this is at the end of verse 6 of chapter 45 in Isaiah. I am the Lord, and there is no other, the one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity. I am the Lord who does all these. And it's as if to say, I'm in total control of the worst and best. Whatever happens, whether it's calamity or well-being, it is ultimately according to my sovereign control. And there's other passages very similar to this. I know that theologians like Bruce Ware call them the spectrum texts, where God is laying out his control over everything. In 1 Samuel 2, we read a very similar statement where Hannah is praying to God, and she's able to say, the Lord kills, this is 1 Samuel 2:6, the Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he set the world on them. And so we're given the sense that God is so sovereign and so in control that he's able to claim this kingly right to both kill and make alive. And that is because, as you said, he's the creator of it all. So it would make sense that everything happens according to his perfect will.
Yeah, I would even extend it, you know, beyond that to say that our very existence in an everyday real sense is very dependent on him as well. I mean, I'm thinking of like, you know, in him we move and have our being. There's a real reality to which the fact that I'm breathing oxygen right now and my heart is beating right now and the atoms and molecules and whatever else makes up the body is holding together by the sovereignty of God, which is, in one sense, is really cool because, I mean, it just shows you, again, how personal and relational God is to be involved, you know, even to that level. But on the other side, it also is just, like, mind-blowing that, like, God is so big, you know, that even holding everything together happens as a product of who he is and what he's actively doing in the world, and not just, you know, God created and then he stepped back, kind of a deist mindset of, oh yeah, I did the creating. Now I'm just going to sit back and watch and see what happens with it. It's much more involved than that. His sovereignty is down to the minute level, which is just a really cool and mind-blowing reality.
And I think so, having established, and there's many other places we can go and we could go to look at God's sovereignty, but I think just having established that this is at least taught in Scripture, and that this idea that God, as you said, over even the details, he has perfect control. I think that when we have that framework, we have to ask, okay, how does this relate to suffering? And one thing to say at the beginning is that when you are going through deep suffering, you can know, according to the biblical witness, you can know that your suffering is not the result of random chance, bad luck, or pure chaos. They are actually, the suffering that you go through is custom designed by God. And this is especially crucial for if you are a believer. They are custom designed by your Father to make you like the Son. And there's different areas in the Bible where it speaks to this, that the ultimate goal in the Christian life is that we would be made like Jesus. But in the context of suffering in particular, we see, for instance, 1 Peter 4:19 says, "Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." Now, I don't know about you, Jamie, but you probably have heard people misapply the teaching of God's sovereignty. In the moment, when someone is suffering, people want to come in, and especially those who are theologically astute, they know their Bibles, they know the teaching on God's sovereignty, but partly it's their timing, and partly it's just the manner in which they bring God's sovereignty to bear in the situation. They misapply it, and they'll say essentially to the sufferer, hey, buck up, get with the program, God is sovereign, he has a purpose, therefore, quit your complaining.
Yeah, no, it's totally true, and I've even, from a pastoral perspective, you know, especially when it comes to the question of evil, the suffering that is a product of evil, I feel like that's even more the case. Like, we're just, our natural response is, I want to defend God. Like, I want to, in some way, explain away why God allows what he allows, or why God is doing what he's doing, or why, another example, not necessarily evil, but in the realm of human suffering, is in the community that my church is in. There is a little girl, I can't remember exactly what her age is, but she's, you know, younger than 10, and got cancer and died. And just super devastating for that family and the community, and even for the majority of the folks in my church, you know, who are friends with that family and know, you know, knew the kid personally and were involved in their lives and stuff. And it's just like, why would God allow, you know, a little kid to die of cancer, like, or to even get cancer? So yeah, there is that tendency to rush in with, I need to, it's my job to defend God. And I really think that's half the motivation, is like, I need a good reason for why God did what he did. But then the other half, of course, is we also want to encourage people and give them hope. And sometimes it's hard to let people suffer and just sit with them, just be with them in that moment, instead of, you know, rushing to like, I need to justify this with like, oh, God is going to use this for your good. And well, that's probably true. And oftentimes it is really true, but that's not at all helpful in that moment by any means.
Yeah. I mean, one way I think that we could express what we're talking about is, I think that God's sovereignty in the midst of evil and suffering should be taught and should be preached from the pulpits, but it often is misapplied in the hospital room or in the counseling office. And what I mean by that is, like Job's miserable comforters, the temptation can be to want to inject all these theological bromides that say God is in control and therefore you should not be complaining. You should not be weeping, and you should not be so disturbed by this thing that has afflicted you, because God's in control, and enough said. But in reality, we see that, A, we don't know all of that went into the suffering. We don't know what caused it. And the fact that God is in control does not mean that there's no room for lament
and there's no room for weeping. You know, God, it says in Scripture, weep with those who weep, and we are to be those who comfort one another, come alongside one another, and encourage one another, who are especially those who are afflicted. So God is not a stoic, and he doesn't call any of us to be a stoic. Jesus wept at the tomb of Lazarus, not because he thought this is the end and Lazarus will never be raised from the dead or never be reunited with his loved ones in heaven. He knew all that. He knew God was in control, but the fact of suffering is very real, and especially in the moment when you're facing that affliction, it can be comforting to know that God is in control, but it's also comforting just to have, and most importantly, to have people to be with you, to show love to you in that moment without needing to spout all these theological truths. And again, they are true to the as far as they go, but when you're not allowing someone to lament, you're actually working against God's intention for that suffering. And you're saying God does not want you to be grieving about this, when in fact God may be using this time to allow that person to grieve through something and to run to the only refuge they have, which is Christ. And to claim, you know, to claim that something is, for instance, what Job's friends did is they claim that Job was suffering because of some sin in his past. You know, they essentially were the sin police coming alongside and saying, Job, there's got to be something you haven't confessed. And although they probably meant well, what they were into the situation more than they knew. And they were actually the ones at fault by the end of the book of Job. Job was taking his anguish to God. He was confronting God with all that he was going through and crying out for help and for explanation. And his friends really were just saying, Job, this is something that you've brought on yourself, not recognizing the full situation that was going on. And so we just need to be careful when we are coming alongside those who are suffering, not to suggest that their suffering is the result of a personal sin that they haven't confessed or something along those lines.
Yeah, I really like the way this is put in Hebrews chapter 2, recognizing that the suffering of Jesus wasn't for the purpose of going to the cross, or it wasn't for the purpose of taking on our sins. The reason Jesus suffered, I mean, Jesus went to the cross to take on our sins, but the reason he suffered, we're told in Hebrews 2, is so that he could relate to us. I mean, Hebrews 2, 14 begins with, now since children have flesh and blood in common, Jesus also shared in these things, so that through his death he might destroy the one holding the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who were held in slavery all their lives by the fear of death. For it is clear that he does not reach out to help the angels, but only to help Abraham's offspring. Therefore, he had to be like his brothers in every way so that he could become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for sin, for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tested and suffered, he is able to help those who are tested. And I just love that, like, reality of Jesus having suffered not for, you know, I mean, to fulfill the wrath of God. He does that on the cross, but he suffers in every way like us so that he can relate to us, so that Jesus can come to us in those times of suffering and literally say, I'm with you in this. Like, I feel you in this. I feel your pain. I've walked out that hurt. I understand what that's like, and I'm with you in it. Like, how cool is that to just have Jesus sit with you like that? You know, I mean, we don't often think of it that way, but that's what it is. Like, Jesus literally sitting with us, and it kind of speaks to the Jewish practice, you know, of being with people in mourning is called, I think it's called sitting in Siva or sitting in Shiva, something like that, where when someone's grieving, you just come and you're with them in the emotion. You're with them in the moment. You're not there to, you know, try and lift them out of that place or try and encourage them or get them not to think the way they're thinking or, you know, any of those things. But instead, you're just there for them. And that's what we see Jesus doing in Hebrews 2 here, is he's just there with us. It's just such a cool, I don't know, it just means a lot to me. And I'm sure keeping that reality in heart when in deep suffering is just a powerful game changer, I would think.
Yeah, and this is something we see in, again, it's actually Isaiah, but this idea that God is with us in our affliction. I mean, there's other examples, for instance, like when Jesus tells the disciples before he ascends, he says, I am with you always, even to the end of this age. And then later we find Jesus saying to the resurrected Jesus, saying to Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, why are you persecuting, not why are you persecuting my church, but why are you persecuting me? And see, Jesus is so identifying with his people that to persecute the church of God is to persecute Jesus. And we get this in one when God is speaking here and he says, do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand, my good hand. And right there we see that God is with us in our suffering. And that is the greatest comfort that we can have when we are in the midst of affliction. We need to hear the voice of God speaking into our situation and telling us that he hasn't abandoned us, that he's with us in the struggle and in the anguish we are experiencing. And I think this is important because I think there are at least three wrong ways that a Christian can respond to suffering. One would be, we could call it the callous group that doesn't think that they will ever suffer or doesn't even want to talk about suffering, wants to stay as distant from suffering as possible because they never see any purpose in suffering. And so they're not very good at comforting others. We could say these are the callous group. Another group might be withdrawn, and that is those who have faced suffering and they ended up just feeling more and more beat up in their suffering, that they withdraw. They are no longer taking risks or living in faith because they know what suffering feels like and they don't like the pain. They want to avoid pain at all costs now, so they are withdrawn. And then those who are numb. And I think the numb group is those who would run to entertainment, addiction, recreation, and basically any other distraction they can find to take their mind off of suffering in hopes of numbing the pain. And what God calls us to do is not to try to numb the pain and run away from suffering or pretend it's not there, but to cry out to him in the midst of that suffering and to know that he is walking through that suffering with us and that he hasn't abandoned us or left us alone. He's right there with us. And as fellow believers, our best encouragement isn't necessarily to say in the moment, God's in full control, but it is at times to say God is with you in this suffering. God knows what you're going through. God hasn't taken his eye off of you. He's with you in this moment. And I think if we are to say anything, that's something that can be powerful and true, and it's scriptural. So I guess just kind of in conclusion, as we've been talking about God's sovereign control over all things in the midst of our suffering, you know, we can read passages like 1 Peter 4:13 to say, rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings. And we can think that rejoice, okay, that means that I just got to have a plastic smile on my face and be a good, happy Christian and ignore the suffering and pain I'm going through. When in reality, what God's sovereignty in the midst of our suffering calls us to do is to lean more heavily on him and seek him more deeply in the midst of that suffering because he is in control, because we haven't been knocked out of his hand. And I think that when we remember that the greatest suffering imaginable, the worst evil imaginable, was when Jesus was mocked, sat upon, beaten, scourged, betrayed, abandoned, and then finally crucified on a Roman cross. In the midst of all of that, Acts 4 tells us that this all happened according to the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, that he was working out all the details even while it seemed like evil had won and that chaos was reigning. Even in the midst of that, God was working out his sovereign plan of redemption, and that it was only because of that suffering that we could be rescued for all eternity. And so this is something that, as we close, my encouragement is to remember that we have a God who suffers alongside us, who has suffered for us on the cross, and that because of that, we can experience the everlasting hope and joy that only Christ can bring. And that's what we are to turn to in the midst of our trials.
You've been listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you want to subscribe, feel free to do so on iTunes or Google Play. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to hit us up on social media or send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. To hear past episodes, go to our website, faithunpacked.com. And as always, we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.